Welcome to the Bridge of Two podcast.
You started it.
I did. Before you're ready, maybe, or maybe not. Can you really ever be ready for a podcast?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know.
I don't know either. We'll find out.
Welcome
on this episode.
Yes, welcome to the Bridge of Two podcast. This is the podcast where we bridge the sci-fi and fantasy realms we love into a nerdcast of epic proportions.
Haven't said that in a while.
No, I haven't. Feels appropriate.
It does feel appropriate.
This feels like a proper podcast when you have a an author that you are video like conferencing into your podcast. It's like, this is real. This is the real thing. So yes, we have Johan Martin here. And Johan, we're so glad to have you. He is the author of Keys of Time or Dream of Stewards, the first book in the Keys of Time series, correct?
Yes. Yes, it is the first book in the Keys of Time series. Yeah, thank you so much, guys, for having me. I'm honored to join you. I do want to say before we get started that you both have the Bridge of Two podcast has dethroned the Joe Rogan Experience as my shower podcast.
Oh, really? That's amazing. I'm honored.
I'm honored.
Well, I mean, I only listen in like 10-minute chunks because that's how long my showers are, but you know, I can get through an episode in a week. So it's been fun.
There you go.
I am honored
to be
your
really
shower
cool
podcast.
Yeah. I need to try to experience a podcast in the shower. I've never done that.
You haven't? It's pretty good.
No. How do you do it? Do you have like a speaker, a special speaker or?
Yeah, we have a Bluetooth speaker. So initially I tried doing like audiobooks, but Audible has this weird thing where like it'll cut in and out and then you'll miss stuff. But for whatever reason, the Spotify app plays perfectly over it. So it's just been like a podcast thing.
Awesome. I'll have to try that out sometime.
Use my phone. I'll set it up by the shower.
I've tried that with podcasts or music or whatever, and I can't get loud enough.
Certain podcasts work for me, some don't. So like Critical Role, I can't listen to that because they get too quiet.
Maybe we're just loud enough, you know. We're a loud podcast. As I whisper.
Although Bluetooth doesn't make it louder, so.
Right.
I'm just
Bluetooth speaker. Nice. So okay. So that we got that first little tangent. That's like the breaks you in, gets you like loose, right? So that's good. So we do want to start off by just talking to Johan about the book and the journey to get there. I'm going to have to hold myself back from being like asking too many like technical like questions about like how do I do this, because I'm also trying to finish revising a book so that I can work on getting it published. And the thing, what you have managed to, the finish line you've managed to cross is like one that I very much, is like a dream of mine. So first of all, what does it feel like? What does it feel like to get there, to like get your book published?
It's an interesting feeling. So I've been working on this, actually like the writing, revising, publishing process for about 6 years. Though the idea has been in my head for probably a couple decades. It feels weird to have it out there. It's a good feeling. It was a good feeling. I remember, we did, an unboxing with my wife and son, and, you know, we just kind of saw the first proof copy of it. And that was kind of like where it hit me and that, oh, this is real. This is actually happening. This isn't just this thing I've been talking about forever. Because for the longest time in like high school and college, like I'd always say, oh, hey, this is totally this like time travel book that I'm going to write someday. And then, you know, shortly after getting married in 2016, my wife's like, you know, you keep talking about this book. Are you going to like write it or what's the deal? So since then it's been the writing process, and like, you know, within the past month, because we released mid-February. It's all kind of come to fruition. So it's this kind of surreal feeling, and you know, you have to start doing things that are outside your wheelhouse, like marketing and promotion, you know, websites and mailing lists and things that, you know, aren't, it's not writing, it's not creating a story. So you have to kind of learn to juggle and put on different hats. So that's sort of what it's felt like the past month or so.
Nice. So you said like high school and college. So like this, the seed of this idea, or would you say, you know, like how much of this book did you kind of, were you figuring out in like high school and college, do you think?
So in high school, I had kind of like a mental outline of the story that I wanted to tell. And I sort of organized it in my head as like, okay, this is a book, you know, I can tell this story in about four books. And it's generally stayed that way as far as like format and how I think of the stories. But it wasn't until college where I outlined the first book and, you know, sort of got my ideas out there and then, you know, started writing around 2016. And like really, that's when I really committed it to paper, and you know, that sort of took on a life of its own. So from that conception of an idea that I had, you know, over a decade ago to where it is now, it is a, I would say very different, but the heart of it's still there.
Awesome. Do you feel like was the outline or the heart of it, was it the first book, or is it the series? Like you obviously have a plan for, you know, future books in this series.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say for the series as a whole, you know, there are definitely certain plot points, certain character revelations that I've had in mind for, you know, books 2, 3, and 4. But with writing the first book, I even though I had those like grand ideas for the future, I still wanted to like put my best foot forward with this first book, and then, you know, make something that could be a standalone if it needed to, but just really writing the best kind of story that I can in the moment. And then when I get to those other events, then that's when we'll deal with that. So that's sort of how I approached this first book, where it could be a standalone. I almost wrote it as a standalone, even though it does tie into a larger series that I have ideas for in the future.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, I'll definitely say it. I finished the book. I read it.
Oh, wow.
It was actually one of those books. I was telling Josh this, because I'm usually a big fantasy guy, but I do have a certain type of book that kind of fits well into your genre that just grips me. And it's and so yeah, I just started reading your book, kind of like that suspense type of book, and then especially when you see the time traveling or everything like that, so it just gripped me, and I ended up finishing the book in about a week roughly. Wow. I get what you're saying. It definitely can be read as like a standalone book, hints of things in the coming to come, you know.
Yeah, and that was sort of the idea behind getting that first book. And yeah, thank you so much for reading that. That means a lot, and that you enjoyed it. I know I listened to a bit of your guys' podcast last week. And I think, Josh, you had mentioned that it almost has like that Jack Reacher, like, you know, kind of guy with a gun thriller, but, you know, it has time travel. So it does have like that science fiction element. And that was sort of like the fun that I wanted to have with it.
And I loved it. And especially the time travel stuff when they started actually doing the time travel and how that worked. It was just a very interesting concept, and it's time travel done differently than kind of what you see. And I really enjoy it. And Josh needs to finish the book already. He needs to stop writing his own and read.
I got a good start on it, and then I'm getting really close to the end of a really important, what feels like a very important revision draft on my book. And so I haven't been able to read almost anything or play any games, or like I haven't been able to do almost anything. Not that I'm constantly writing, but it's just I can only basically do the stuff I'm supposed to be doing, and then try to carve out, you know, some time to write. So, but I'm definitely you know, hooked in the sense that I want to see the book through to completion, and I know I will. I'm probably at the end of March, because I've kind of put a deadline on myself for this, to treat this almost like a National Novel Writing Month for the rest of it of March, to try to knock out this revision. But because I'm adding, it's a revision draft, but I had gotten to a point where I needed to write a lot more words, and so like fill some holes and gaps and stuff, and so that's what I'm doing now. But tell me this. So how does it feel, you know, a book that you've worked on been writing for 6 years, let alone, you know, like planning and everything, and then to hear someone say they finished it in a week?
It's interesting. It's like, I'm sure you spend a lot of time, you know, putting together, this podcast, recording, editing, and then all that. And then, you know, some guy on the other side just like listens in the shower, and, you know, it's like all this, but it's, it's weird. It's very surreal. I think that's the easiest way to put it. It's funny you mentioned like not having, enough time to read what you want to read and like watch TV and do other things. That I kind of feel the same way, with writing. And then, like, you know, there are also other books and things that I want to read that I want to do. You know, like I have my full-time job, and then, you know, nighttime is usually writing time, or like, you know, working, you know, doing marketing stuff for the book. And then I don't get to watch as much TV or like read as much as I want to do. So, I totally get it. And I am curious, not to shift too much, but I am curious about, your work, Josh. So you said you're revising right now. Do you have the first draft completed? Is that where you are?
So I did a horrible thing. and I was writing, I've rewritten, like I wrote a first draft for NaNoWriMo in 2019. And, yeah. In order to get to an ending in 50,000 words, I skimmed some stuff, left some chapters open, like, you know, like skimmed over some stuff I knew I'd have to write later, so I could actually write the ending. And then after that, I started revising that. And then I realized that I needed to make some pretty major changes early on in the book. So I had basically needed to do another first draft. And so I did that. I started that and then finished the majority of it for NaNoWriMo 2020. But I did not finish the book. And I got really close to finishing it. I didn't finish the first draft. So then I do things weird. I read Return of the King first in the Lord of the Rings series. But then I like went back and started revising that draft and like making notes of like, cause I guess it was kind of like, I couldn't really see the ending of the book. So I was like, well, you know, I'm not going to, I feel like I'm losing steam on this because I'm just trying so hard to figure out the ending. And I think there was stuff fundamentally I didn't understand about the story that I was writing and the characters and stuff. I needed to understand more so that I could see where the ending needed to go. So then I started doing some revision drafts. And so this one, I did a big chunk of this during NaNoWriMo this year. And, have you ever done NaNoWriMo?
No, I've not. I know a lot of people who have, you know, National Novel Writing Month. It just seemed like such a big feat, and I'm already like, I'm a slow reader. I'm a slow writer. I couldn't imagine, especially, you write, epic fantasy, right? Like we're not talking about a small number of words. This isn't a novella of like 40,000 words. You're probably, you know, in the 150,000 plus, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm over 100,000 now, and it's heading towards 150,000, but I'm hoping I don't have 50,000 more words, but
Yeah, that's an enormous feat to squeeze into a month. So I've never participated in it. It's mostly because it would be too hard for me to push out that many words in a short amount of time. But I do like the idea of it. I think it helps a lot of people, especially with writer's block, to just commit to writing. Right. Even when, you know, like, oh, this may not be the best, but I need to get those words out there, and then I'll be able to go back and to revise afterwards. So I think it's a great thing. I've not done it yet.
Yeah. It's not really possible to write a complete full novel, but kind of helps you, like you said, get the inner critic kind of silence the inner critic and so that you can kind of let your subconscious sort of explore what's fun and interesting. Cause it basically what happens is you find something to write, even if you get stuck because of the word count. If you really commit to the word count, you will just start writing and it will just take you into places that it wants to go, which is definitely very interesting. But you know, it's also difficult in the revision. And then that's, I think, why I definitely found it very valuable the first time I did it. But, you know, I did have to ultimately do another first draft after that. But yeah, so I have not written the ending yet, but I did, just recently I was writing and, had kind of this epiphany of, I was writing a scene that kind of like gave me the breadcrumbs to the ending in a sense. And, when I realized it was like something else I had written, I had been like mulling over in my head in the prologue. And when I added that to the prologue, and then I was writing the scene that I was writing later in the book, those two things connected. And then, and I was like, oh, that's kind of where this whole story feels like it makes sense for it to go. And yeah. It was really a kind of a emotional thing too, because it's kind of sad. And I was like, no. Yeah. And so, but it was kind of like, that feels like I just found the ending. So, or some version of that. So, yeah. So that's exciting. Did you have a moment like that with writing your book at all?
I've had a lot of moments like that, writing the book, and it's so fun when it happens. It's like, you know, you write yourself into a problem, and then, the answer, almost comes to you, how everything is connected. So, you know, like for my book, there'll be a revelation in the next book about a particular character, and like the truth about their identity. And so like, this is an epiphany that happened to me once while, you know, we were out hiking, my wife and I, and then brother-in-law, sister-in-law, we were out in the middle of a hike. And this was while I was still writing the first draft of the first book. And then all of a sudden this idea, it came into my head, and not in a way of like, oh, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you did this? No, it came into my head as in like, oh, this is what is actually going on. This is how it's always been. So writing's interesting how it happens that way. I know Stephen King, his memoir On Writing, he describes it as, you know, it's like excavating a fossil. You know, it was always there. It takes a writer to uncover it. And then like, the more you write, the more you read and revise, like the more that you uncover this fossil that's in the ground. So it's a really fun process. And I've had that epiphany moment happen, several times. Even in this book, there were certain, connections. I won't go into the spoiler territory, but, it is a lot of fun. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I think writing, at least for me personally, brings a lot of joy. And like, I would always find a way to do it. You know, even if I couldn't sell books, like I want to be able to participate in the story and to share it with others. And, you know, hopefully others will take away something meaningful from it. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. Whether you outline a bit or a big outliner or not, it's still kind of, you're still discovering, even if you're discovering in the outline or you're discovering in the prose, where I'm definitely more discovering in the prose. I'm not very good at outlining. That's something I think I need to improve on. But yeah, that's definitely how it feels like when you're like, I don't like this part. I don't like what I wrote. And then you reread, you start reading it, and then you start to see why you don't like it. And it's almost like you, because it's wrong, because that's not what it is. It's something else. And then you start changing it, and you start, it starts looking right, which is definitely a very interesting thing. It's, we could get very deep and philosophical probably about it. You know, I definitely have a, you know, my faith attached to, you know, my writing and stuff. I almost feel like, there's a story that is like permeated into our world. And I think sometimes stories, when they resonate with that story, is when they start to feel more true and more right and more like what they're supposed to be. I don't know if that's, if you feel that way or not, or, but,
that makes sense. So, you know, me personally, I consider myself a person of faith. I'm a Christian, but I'm not, the way I describe it, like I'm not, I wouldn't consider myself, a Christian writer in that, I seek to write Christian fiction. However, so often, like my faith is a part of, who I am. And when you're writing, when you're being true to the words you're putting on the page, a lot of that just ends up coming out into the page, whether or not you're aware of it or not. So I will find, you know, some of those nuggets. I don't know if you guys have seen any of that in A Dream of Stewards, but I know, like, as I've reread it, I've seen like little nuggets of like, oh, you know, that comes from my faith. I didn't necessarily plan for it to be there, but you know, that they're there nonetheless. You know, and I think it just comes out.
Yeah, as I was reading, I've definitely noticed a couple of things. It was more of just like I wonder if that was intentional or not. It wasn't like pervasive or anything like that. It was just as also someone that's a person of faith, it was like, oh, that, you know, huh.
Yeah, I've wrestled with that, like, because I'm a Christian as well. And I could never write, I don't think I could ever write like a Jesus character, like a representative of Jesus. Like, that's the part I wrestle
with. Aslan.
Right. Like, I don't think I could ever do anything like Aslan, because I would be like trying to make it perfectly, exactly theologically right. And then it wouldn't be an interesting story. And I think in some ways it's almost more affecting, you know, to try to tell a true story. And if you believe in those things, if those things move and shape you, then the truth that's in them is more deeply embedded than that. And I feel like I'm like, it sounds like I'm knocking that C.S. Lewis but I'm not. I just don't think I could do that. I don't think I could pull it off. Somehow he did, but he gets like,
flack. Yeah,
like he gets flack for, people saying, well, he believed in Druids. Like there's those talking trees, that's Druids and stuff. And there's like representations of like other deities and stuff in it that are like bowing down to, I think, Aslan at some point and things like that. So he gets flack for how he didn't do it, you know, like perfectly theologically right. So I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, maybe, but
yeah. And I think there's great freedom in when you're writing fiction to just stay committed to telling the best kind of story that you can tell. And like, you know, especially like as Christians, like as a Christian, I believe that, truth will always surface. It will always come out. It will be there. So like, as long as I'm committed to telling a story that I believe to be true, whether or not, regardless of what my intentions are, truth will always go forward. So it's a little freeing in that. So I try not to censor myself too much when I write. Like in my book, there's not, you know, there are no F-bombs, there are no, there's no sex scenes or anything crazy like that. But at the same time, I do try to bring characters to life that reflect the way the world is. So like the villain in this book, Adam Drazen, when I write his scenes, I really do try to get in his head and to show like why he believes what he believes and to try and make the best argument for that. And almost taking myself out and, you know, cause I can be there to like make, you know, the counter argument, but I try to take myself out. So I think a good example in art, like, what is it? The God's Not Dead series, or stuff like that, where it's just kind of like they have caricatures of people who have a different point of view instead of like what, people who hold those views are. Yeah. So I think it is important to writing to put out characters that reflect how people think and how they are.
Right. Yeah, I think so too.
Characters that are real and believable, you know.
Yeah.
And I think trying to get into a character when you write them is one of the best ways to do it, you know. Instead of just writing, like you said, like a caricature of what, you know, this person might think or believe or whatever, you actually try to make it realistic in the sense of what they're actually thinking and they're, you know, and I think you did a pretty decent job with Adam Drazen in that, you know, you can understand what his thought process in it with when you were explaining different things.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And that's a character that, it didn't start out that way. You know, initially, I think in the very earlier drafts, he was more of like, you know, the mustache twirling villain, just like, oh, I'm evil to be evil. And it's fun, but it doesn't work. Or at least it didn't work in this story. Like I think maybe that there are instances where it can be done, but it just wasn't working for the story. So, you know, it's something that had to be revised over time. And it seemed like, the more you humanize somebody and like insert those like you know those tiny bits of empathy, it really does help to bring a character to life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a scene, and I won't bring the scene up because I don't. Josh probably hasn't gone that far, but there is a scene with Adam Drazen in it that definitely gives you that sense of like, yes, he is the bad guy.
Yeah. And
yes, what he's doing is not necessarily right. But you can understand him, and especially in this specific scene, you can understand him.
How much, Jeremiah? Are you going down? Dark
path? Depends. Is the FBI listening right now?
is this? I think I know what scene you're talking about. Right around the middle of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I know exactly the scene you're talking about. And that was one of the ones that. Took a lot of revision to get there and to bring it out.
Well, I think I definitely enjoyed that scene. I enjoyed that scene in the sense of getting to kind of understand that character a little bit more in his thought process of things, which I like with villains. I'm a bit with my storytelling. I really like, cause I like stories, and
yeah,
it comes back to my favorite too. I really like the story of good versus evil, but I also don't like that when it becomes this guy is blatantly good, this guy is blatantly evil. I like it when the villain has a little bit of you can feel a little bit of empathy for him, or you can understand to a certain extent why he's doing what he's doing, and I do think you did a pretty decent job with that with Adam Drazen in this book.
Thank you. And that's actually the types of stories that I'm drawn to as well, where, you know, you're heroes and but your protagonist as well is also three-dimensional. Yes. So it's weird how you also have stories like Lord of the Rings with Sauron, how I don't know how but they managed to pull that off. Like I still think Sauron is like the perfect villain for that story. Even though it, you know, it's very much like, oh, this is evil for the sake of being evil.
Yeah. I mean, there is like more, a little bit more nuance to him than comes across in the like main trilogy. Because he was like corrupted and he had like a certain view of he had a certain view of the way things should be, like, you know, people do, like Bill and Stu. Had a lot to do with order, and he was trying to bring things into what he thought was like order, but it was, you know, which at the expense of, you know, freedom or you know, beauty or anything like that, like order at all costs, kind of. But yeah, the way he's represented in Lord of the Rings for sure, like in the main books, is, and maybe it works because it's almost, he is a little more distant of a mm-hmm. villain, right? You know, you've got his minions and stuff that are obviously very much not very nuanced. You don't really, it doesn't really get close to him. So maybe it wouldn't work as well if he was more prominent and just kind of that, you know, classic, just, he's just evil. He's just the bad guy, you know, but maybe because he's more distant threat or something. I don't know.
But. Yeah. And I know at least, in the Peter Jackson trilogy, he almost feels like, like not a character, a person, more of like just the presence of like evil, right. Especially how he uses those around him to do his bidding. So I've always thought that was really well done, whether it was Saruman or, you know, the orcs on the ground, whoever. It's like there's always those doing his bidding.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like he's just like the representation of evil that's like moving and stretching out into the world.
Sort of, yeah,
which worked really well for the story.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think he's a good guy, but
just misunderstood.
Just misunderstood.
They bullied up on him. They surrounded him.
Yeah, you should just give him his ring back.
Yeah, right. It's his ring.
They blow.
It's his ring. There's only one Lord of the Rings. Come on.
Exactly.
And he's the star. Looks called Lord of the Rings. So, I just have one more question, and then maybe we'll get closer to our drink break. Your self-publishing, did you try to go any other routes, or did you kind of just say, no, I think I'm just going to try to self-publish this and do it myself?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I did not first intend to self-publish. This book is self-published. You know, typically you either go the self-publishing route or you try to do it traditionally, where it's typically represented by one of the big five publishers out there. So, you know, Penguin, Random House, Simon and Schuster, you know, these are the guys that'll put your stuff in Barnes and Noble, and get you on the New York Times bestseller, all that. That had always been the way that I wanted to go. And after writing, I'd spent quite a bit of time pitching. I want to say about a year trying to pitch to different literary agents to represent the work, to get it to a big publishing house. You know, that didn't work out so well. And I just wasn't very good at pitching the book, or it also seemed to be in that genre or category that would be difficult to market and sell. But you know, this is still a story that, you know, like I said, I'd spent 6 years writing, and it's very important to me that it get out there. So I did decide to self-publish, but I didn't just want to, you know, log on to Kindle Direct Publishing, upload a Word document and put it out there. I still wanted to put out the best possible book that I could put out. So I spent a lot of time looking for the right editor. You know, thankfully I found one. Guy by the name of Tyler Sherman did a fantastic job editing and just really, really bringing the story to what it is now. You know, I hired a professional cover designer, guy by the name of Jeff Brown, who's done a lot of, he mostly does like traditionally published works. He's done a lot of bestsellers for science fiction and fantasy, and I really liked his work. And so, you know, I had him, and, you know, like throughout the process, I'm like, the question is, how do I put out the best possible book that that I could put out, because you only debut once. So, you know, I was able to do that, and you know, I'm pretty happy with the final product. And right now, working on getting an audiobook, which should be coming out. I want to say in the next few weeks or so. Like, I've hired a professional voice actor to do it, and he's almost done. He's basically in the final editing and proofing process. And so, you know, we're going to get that to the Audible folks and then get that out. But yeah.
That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah. I definitely, that was one of the first things I noticed, when I saw the book. I was like, that is an awesome looking cover. You know, and that is definitely, I've through experience of just reading books from first time authors, and then what I've heard from others in the industry, you know, that's the, like, having a really good cover is really important for a debut, you know, author. So, you know, it's a great cover. Definitely caught my eye. And, you know, yeah, it's a good product. You know, I mean, it's, does not feel, and I don't mean in a bad way, but you, like you said, there is, it's definitely, if you want your book to be published, you can have it published in, you know, very short amount of time with not a whole lot of effort through, like, just going straight to an ebook. And but yeah, you wanted to put something out in the world that you know, kind of does what you, the work you've done, justice, you know. And I think,
yeah, that's great.
And so and I think that ultimately that'll, you know, I think that'll pay, that has probably already paid off in certain ways. You probably have reached people better because of that, and you will, you know, continue to. So, you know, so congratulations on that, because that just sounds daunting. And I'm sure you could attest that it is to some extent.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. And that was very much the goal. And yeah, as far as the cover, that was all Jeff Brown. Like, I talked to him about the story, and like, he considered genre and, like, you know, how that fits into it. So I think he did an absolutely fantastic job at that. But yeah, with self-publishing, it can get a bad rap sometimes, because there are people who will just, you know, put something up there that they haven't got edited, they haven't gotten proofed, you know, and they haven't taken the time. And so, you know, if you have enough of those out there, it's like, oh, well, that's self-published. So, you know, I know that when I was considering it, I'm like, okay, if I'm going to go in, I want to do it right. I don't want to fall into that category. And, you know, like you said, I've spent so much time putting this together, and it deserves that justice. So I'm really happy with it. And I'm glad you guys have enjoyed it and have me on the podcast to talk about it. This is really cool.
Absolutely. All right. So real quick, let's do, before we do our drink break, let's try to do,
yes.
You got any, you can keep going with it. Johan, any sci-fi fantasy stuff you've been getting to this week besides your book related? Obvious time travel that you actually do.
Yeah. Because we know it's a biography, autobiography. Sorry.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I just had to change the names of the agencies and people, but it's all, you know, we can edit this out, right? Like, this isn't, this isn't going anywhere. Yeah. So as far as sci-fi and fantasy, so like I said, it's been hard to, like, carve out the time to consume something. But there are two pieces of work, and I'm going to stretch it more than just a week. So on the reading front, I've been trying to get through this science fiction book called Hyperion. I don't know if you guys heard of it or read it, but it is a fantastic book. So it came out in like 1989, I want to say. But it's the setup or the premise is similar to the Canterbury Tales, where you have this group of pilgrims who venture to this planet, Hyperion, right before it's about to basically be obliterated by war. This takes place thousands of years in the future, and there's this mysterious creature called the Shrike that people don't really understand. And so like it's told through these six different perspectives, six different chapters. And so you have, a detective. So you get like a hard-boiled, neo-noir detective story. You get the perspective of a soldier and like how he's tied to the planet. And you get a story from a priest. And like there are all these very different types of stories and genres, but it is very much science fiction. So I'm getting close to wrapping that book up. That's been fun. I want to say it's probably... not that I've read too many books this year, but I want to say one of my favorites within this past year. Another sci-fi item, my wife and I finally finished The Expanse season 6.
Sure.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great show. It's been one of my favorites. I've read the first book, Leviathan Wakes, and I do want to get through all of them. I wish this, and I'll obviously go into spoilers, but I wish this past season was maybe a little bit longer and we could have done more stuff. But overall, I enjoyed the series a lot, and it's something I would like to revisit again.
Is that show still going?
This was the final season.
Yeah, and it's the final season.
I don't know. They may have just come out with the last book, or it may be about to come out. The show ended before the books did.
The books did, yeah.
But I'm told that there is like a jump in time between the book they finished on and the next one. So it kind of was a natural place to end the series. People who've made the show, I think it's Alcon or something like that. They have kind of left the door open that, who maybe down the road they might find another place to continue the show, or another way, maybe a movie or something like that. But so they kind of left the door open that it's not like they never want to revisit and try to go into those other stories, the later books. But I think it was just the contract with Amazon was done. And
yeah, I've read Leviathan Wakes twice, actually. I've read it and I've listened to it back when I was on the interfacility trip doing hour long transfers.
I've read it too. It's definitely a good book, and
And I really liked it. Yeah. I just didn't watch the show yet. I've always meant to go watch it. I've watched a couple episodes and I enjoyed it. I just don't have the time now to go sit down and watch a show, so I haven't been able to. But maybe I'll have one of our newer shows.
I'd be very interested, because I know later we're going to be talking about adaptations, and like looking at Leviathan Wakes and The Expanse. I thought if you've read Leviathan Wakes, season 1 is like almost verbatim that. It was a very faithful adaptation.
That's good.
Yeah.
And then the Hyperion too. I've seen it. I see it in the bookstore all the time, actually. The Hyperion. And I look at it, and the cover is one of those covers that draws my attention. And I've just never picked it up and got it.
It's like I think it's like kind of like a sci-fi classic a little bit.
Yeah, it looks like it.
So yeah, it's a sci-fi classic. It's one of those like hidden gems that I feel like has starting to rise more to popularity now than it had been in the past. But the cover also got me. It's crazy how like people judge books by their covers, or at least like pick them up based on their covers. But it has been one of my favorite things that I've read, and I'm still not done with it. I'm 92% according to my Kindle Paperwhite.
Okay. Nice. Yeah.
Home stretch.
Any new and interesting things?
What do I have to offer?
Been that kind of week?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have anything other than writing. There's a book I've listened to a couple chapters of it, but I just have not gotten far that I'm reading through. It's by Michael J. Sullivan. He's a fantasy author, And he has a series. He has a lot of books, but he has a series. And this is the first book in that series. It's called Theft of Swords. And have not seen any swords stolen yet. So I'm pretty disappointed so far.
in the first page.
But but no, it's definitely an interesting book so far. Some friends of mine are big fans of his and have been trying to get me to read it. So I'm definitely trying to. And it's not that I don't like it. I just have not been able to get into a book, you know, to really let myself just get lost in a book or whatever. Other than that, I mean, not really. I watched some footage of Elden Ring, some gameplay footage of this video game Elden Ring. And I'm definitely, you know, planning on getting that game and playing it. Just once again, I can't do it right now. But yeah, next month, hopefully. I'm not sure. I'm still scared though, because I'm watching it and watching, like, it looks very hard and
it's hard, but we can play together.
Die a lot, and yeah,
and I'll be able to help you out.
Okay, I'm not very good at games where you have to like, strategize.
It's a learning curve.
I'm more like hack and slashy, but yeah, maybe I can figure it out. Anyway, but
so the Elden Ring, is this Elder Scrolls?
No, it's a Dark Souls sequel. It's like kind of a Dark. It's like the same people that made Dark Souls. This is like their next series or whatever.
I guess. I don't know if it's gonna be a series. You know what Dark Souls is?
No.
It's a dark fantasy.
Look inside.
It's like a pretty big dark fantasy game that heavily draws on the fact that it's a difficult game to play. Like people, and they've had all together. They have five games that have come out now. Six with Elden Ring, but they're very popular. Oh, wow. And they're very big their storytelling wise is they don't just tell a linear story through their game. They actually do a lot of it through item descriptions and everything like that. And when you pick up items, they have an item description. That's kind of how most people find out the story and the lore of the world and everything like that. But this most recent one, Elden Ring, came out. And so I've been playing it and my brother's been playing all that. And it's a huge game. And it's very fun. And it's actually the lore and the atmosphere of the game has actually really gotten my creativity side coming out as well.
Oh, so, really?
So it's been very fun for me, and I want Josh to play it so that I can play with him.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've heard a lot of chatter about it. I don't have a lot of time to play games, but I feel like every other YouTube video that comes up, it's like, oh, we're playing Elden Ring. Like it's very popular right now, from what I understand.
It is one of the most popular games right now.
Yeah,
justifiably so. It is a very, very good game. So,
what about you, Jeremiah? I know what you're going to say already.
I read.
you're supposed to wait until April.
No, I haven't played Elden Ring. I've been playing a lot of Elden Ring, more than I should. But I've been playing with my brother, and my brother lives up in a different state, so that's kind of how we chat. Is we sit and play a game together. So I've been playing that. Like I was saying earlier, it's got my creative juices flowing as well. Drawing and stuff like that. It's a very visually appealing game, so that's been fun to play. Been reading still. I don't know if I said it last podcast, but I finished book 5 of Wheel of Time.
I don't remember if you said that either. I know you were close, but
I know I finished that, and then I immediately picked up Keys of Time,
right?
Which was a really nice to read compared to Wheel of Time. A lot. But other than that, that's reading wise, that's about it. I haven't really done much else either. Work and school.
Yeah.
It's picking back up again. So it's bike week here in Daytona. So work is aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the best way to put it.
Yeah. Jeremiah's an EMT, right? Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So
EMT in paramedic school. So. I get my sci-fi fantasy where I can, but other than that, like I said, with Elden Ring, the creative, give me a creative juice filling. I have officially, Josh, and I haven't told you this yet. I've officially started on a short comic.
Really?
I have. Got the few first bits down. I'm doing some outlining as far as that, how the panels are going to come out and what's going to happen in them and some dialogue. Awesome. And I know how I want it to end. And so now I'm kind of getting the middle part going. It's going to be very short. And I'm using the lore and setting of Elden Ring to kind of help me out a little bit. And so this is just going to be really just going to be good practice for me for when I eventually end up doing my comic book that I talked about a while ago.
Okay. So. Cool. Awesome. Can't wait to see that. Are you going to use the character you drew, you put on your Instagram?
I am.
Okay.
It's the character I'm using now. I'm like, I don't even know if I'll post the whole comic or anything like that. I might post it, you know, page by page, whatever, but it's more, I guess it's more of a practice for me just to kind of actually do a comic,
right?
Figure out how to lay out panels and how to, what is visually appealing and how to make an action scene through the artwork and kind of work a little bit on telling visual, using visuals for storytelling instead of a narrative, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Yeah. Started that a few days ago. So we'll see how that goes.
Keys of Time comic. JK. No pressure.
But yeah, that's about it for me though.
Awesome. Well, let's take a break, quick break, grab our drinks. We've got Maduro from Cigar City Brewing,
right? Cigar City, Maduro. Yeah. I do have a story about that. I got to go grab mine as well.
Let's go grab ours and then we'll do the story. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Ready to try these drinks
now? Tell us the story about this drink.
Yeah, so we're drinking Cigar City Maduro. I actually had Cigar City for the first time when I lived in Tampa. So my wife Erica and I, we met going to the University of South Florida there in Tampa. Cigar City is one of those breweries there that, you know, it's very much a part of that city and something that we enjoyed a lot of. And it's beer that I had introduced to my, at that time, to be in-laws. We'd moved to DC in 2015, separately before, you know, that's a story in itself, but before getting married. You know, I had asked for, her father's blessing in marriage over FaceTime. And the way that I had suggested doing it was over a beer. This was the beer, Cigar City Maduro, that my father-in-law and I drank while I was asking for his blessing. And we did it virtually too. So
it's awesome.
Yeah.
Ahead of your time.
Yeah. And it's a good solid beer. I've been a home brewer before. My wife and I, we've brewed our own beer. We try to go to local breweries and stuff. So we're huge into different types of beer. I know not a lot of people are into IPAs or, you know, sours and some of the crazier stuff out there. So like when I introduce a beer, I try to find something that's, you know, a little more, drinkable. Cause I know IPAs especially can have that punch to the tongue. If you're not ready for it, they can be very bitter. This is a brown ale. Like I'm comfortable introducing this to most people. So I hope you guys enjoy it.
All right. Excited to try it. It looks good.
Anything to read on it? You want to read the description or you?
Me? I'll read it. Maduro Brown Ale, named after a dark cigar wrapper, Maduro Brown Ale boasts notes of semi-sweet chocolate, toffee, and hints of fresh coffee. Complex and full-bodied, our malt-flavored ale is brewed with flaked oats to add depth of character.
I like oats.
Just the way that's written makes me want to drink it, or I'm trying it.
And I like complex. All right. We're going to give it a try.
Cheers.
Cheers. That's good.
That is good. I like that. It's different than the kind of stuff I usually drink. Not that different, but definitely come more complex. Gosh, Jesus. I like the almost, I don't, I mean, how are, the composition of the tastes, not that we're like, I have any like good ways of describing like alcohol or whatever, but, it definitely does remind me a little bit of a cigar.
I think they were going for the cigar paper, that they use to wrap cigars.
That's what it says, cigar, dark cigar wrapper.
Yeah.
It's named after that. So I don't know if it's supposed to taste like, it's good.
It is very good. It's very easy to drink. I'm not the biggest beer person.
I like the semi-sweet,
but this is good.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Toffee tastes like, so I think we had a beer or something the other day that had like supposed to have some kind of toffee flavor, and I just don't know what toffee tastes like, but this tastes good.
So. I'm sure I'm wrong, but I equate toffee to caramel for some reason.
Hmm. I think of taffy when I think of toffee.
Oh, that's definitely not right.
What do you think, Johan? Can you enlighten us about toffee, please?
Toffee. Well, you know, as a toffee connoisseur, I must say that I know absolutely nothing about toffee. but I do have that strange word association with toffee and caramel as well. I want to say, was it like, there's like a Lifesaver like creams. I don't know if they make them anymore, but back in like early 2000s, late 90s, I think those were both flavors. You had like strawberry cream, toffee,
you're
caramel.
Right. You're talking about, yeah, those are good.
Yeah I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they make them anymore, right? Like they're like, I've not seen them in forever, so I just assume they died out.
You want to know what toffee
with is. The dinosaurs,
yeah, like the dinosaurs.
So adaptations, you know, to adapt,
yeah. Yeah, I was gonna say that's actually a perfect segue. Dinosaurs adaptations.
Oh, there you go.
Animals. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should they keep making Jurassic Park movies?
Were those books?
They were. Jurassic Park was a Michael Crichton novel, sci-fi.
I have never seen or read Jurassic Park. So
I don't know if Jurassic World was one.
Probably not.
The Lost World was also a Michael Crichton book, but I'm not sure if it came out after the movie or right before. But I don't think there's the Jurassic Park 3 or a Jurassic World Crichton book.
So we're on Jurassic. Should we stay? Have you seen Jurassic?
I have not seen Jurassic Park.
Have you seen any of the Jurassic Park movies?
I've seen like bits and pieces.
I have to rethink my. Our friendship's not really.
It's one of those movies where I've never had a desire to watch it.
The first movie is like so good. It's one of those movies that's very rewatchable. It's just very great. It's almost got a horror feel to it. And it's got dinosaurs. So I mean,
I'm not a big dinosaur fan.
You gotta watch it. You just gotta give it a try.
Right, I'll give it a try.
It's got that sense of adventure, and then you get that iconic John Williams score, you know, like when they first see living dinosaurs for the first time, it was just like that moment.
I'll have to watch it. Maybe are your kids old enough to watch it?
They would love to watch it until they had to go to sleep that night. Ellie's getting close to that age where she could handle it, but she's still in the stage where, and I'm not ready to necessarily burst her bubble, where like dinosaurs are like nice and friendly and stuff. And in those movies, the dinosaurs are the antagonists, you know, the dinosaurs are they're trying to survive the dinosaurs. So she would watch it and she'd be like, why is the dinosaur? Like, why, where are the nice dinosaurs? <She'd be very confused. laughs> But,
it's anyway. Not the Land Before Time.
No, it is not.
The Land Before Time.
You've seen that?
Yes.
Okay, good. You're redeemed. But yeah. Well, let's not stay on to those too long since you haven't seen it. But because there is a new one coming out. Hopefully will be the last for a while. But
yeah, those are the Jurassic World ones, right?
Yeah, the Jurassic World ones, which just don't feel the same as the original.
I feel like kind of a tangent, but that is what we're getting with a lot of these movies, is they're where I feel like they're taking what very well known like movies and IPs, I guess. And just burning them to the ground with the amount of content they're putting out, and it's not bad content, but it's like not great content either. Mm. Yeah. And a good example is, and this is coming from someone who is in love with Star Wars, there's so much Star Wars content coming out right now that it's like I'm getting tired of it.
Cancel the Obi-Wan show.
Absolutely not. That keep that going. I feel like it's probably starting to be the same with Jurassic Park. Just make new ideas.
Yeah.
It does feel a bit oversaturated with the content, the nostalgia bait, like, oh, you guys love this property, right? It's like, all right, you're now gonna hate it after a while.
We're gonna like force feed it to you, basically.
And it's gonna be subpar.
So what you're saying, Jeremiah, is they need to make more adaptations.
Yeah, I do. I think there's so yes. I think there's a lot of books out there that make great.
Yeah.
Not necessarily movies, but TV shows.
But then that brings the question though, is like, which is what a lot of like a good kind of example of this discussion of adaptations is Tolkien stuff and like Rings of Power coming out, and everyone's like getting like worried about it and kind of piling on it, because there's that, you have the segment of fans, right, who are like, yeah, let's see what they can do, and you know, if they change some things, then well, you still have the original thing. And it doesn't have to change that necessarily. But then you have the fans where it's like almost tarnishes, you know, that thing. It's like, no, don't you touch this. Don't you touch this, because we've seen how they did with this adaptation, and you know, we're all worried about it. So that's the tension, right, with adaptations, is it'd be cool to see it, but at the same time, you know, what the end product is like, do you want to see it like that? You know, depending on what it is. I'm not necessarily ragging on Rings of Power, because we've already talked about that and how we're holding our judgment off on that. But like The Hobbit, for example, right? It's like The Hobbit had never been made into a movie series, let alone a trilogy. It had made it into a cartoon, but that gets a lot of flack because of the liberties they took with that. Have you seen the Hobbit movies, Johan?
Yes. So I've seen all three. And I thought it was strange that there were three films, based on a single short book that, preceded The Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings, which had one movie per book, and that made sense. And then you got the extended editions and you could do a bit more, but like to stretch out a small book into three movies kind of seemed like a bit of a studio cash grab. I didn't hate all of the Hobbit movies. I think there were things that I did like and appreciate about it, but it felt thin and stretched, you know, like not enough butter over too much bread.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. And I think that's part of the problem with some of these adaptations, where they kind of try to stretch it out like that. Like The Hobbit is a great example of that. It does kind of feel like just a cash grab. I feel like a lot of what was told could have been told in less. I don't know, if you're going just off the Hobbit movie in particular, or the Hobbit book in particular, like that does not need three whole movies. They added a bunch of other stuff, right, which I think is,
well, they had to, right, because they said originally it was going to be two movies, so which I think would have been more, wouldn't have felt as bad, because they wanted to kind of link it more closely with Lord of the Rings, so mm-hmm. So it was going to have a different tone in the book, because you know, Tolkien wrote the Lord of the Rings after, and then kind of made some changes to The Hobbit to kind of make it match up a little bit more. But you didn't really get in The Hobbit like this really ominous sense that there's something bad out there leading into The Lord of the Rings. You know what I mean? In the books, mm-hmm. or in the book books. But, you know, in the movies, they kind of wanted to kind of, you know, make it seem like it was leading into The Lord of the Rings, which I think there was room for it because of some of the things that, for instance, in The Hobbit, like Gandalf keeps like going off and just leaving them because he's doing things that they cover in the movies. But because they stretched out to three movies, they had to add in some lot more subplots and things like that that were completely, you know, non-canonical, you know, if you use that term maybe, and just kind of made it feel like, you guys said, more stretched and more, just didn't feel the same, you know, as Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and all the CGI and the green screens, like I feel like the original Peter Jackson trilogy holds up so much better than The Hobbit, even though it came 10 years before. Like it ages really well because they did so much work in camera with practical effects, you know, like I prefer the practical makeup orcs versus, you know, the CGI. And it's just, I feel like it holds up so much better.
And it's also not to say too that the Hobbit movies are bad, because they're still enjoyable.
I think they're good movies. Yeah. They're just not, they could have been a better adaptation.
Yeah. A lot better. I think they could have been a better adaptation.
I thought the first half of Unexpected Journey was done really well. You know, especially, you know, when all the dwarves come in and they start singing over the Misty Mountains, like that. Mm-hmm. That for me, when I watched it, like it gave me goosebumps. But it felt like they were trying to stretch too much, and they're like, oh, we need to throw in a love triangle and, you know, have all of this stuff because this has to be a trilogy and it has to be an epic trilogy. I think it would have done, you know, just fine as like one or two movies. It's funny since we're talking about Lord of the Rings, I do think as like when it comes to adaptations that Peter Jackson's original Lord of the Rings trilogy, in my opinion, is kind of like the gold standard for this is how you adapt a work. And there's a lot that goes in it because, you know, I've not read all of Lord of the Rings. I've read, you know, maybe about half of the Fellowship. Tolkien's writing style can be challenging. I'll say that. You know, when you get into the history of Bilbo's second cousin twice removed, and you know, all of these things. But Peter Jackson, he took the material and said, hey, like where is the story, and how do we take the story from this medium and then project it onto that medium and, you know, preserve that integrity while also doing things unique to the medium of visual storytelling, you know, where we can add in an iconic soundtrack that wasn't there, but it still feels like Lord of the Rings. So I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, it is considered the gold standard. I still watch those movies. Like my wife and I, we watch them like, I don't know, every couple of years or so. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just always fun to revisit.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the thing about like the Lord of the Rings. It wasn't just a great adaptation because it was just 100% faithful to the book. There's things they had to kind of like look at and say, you know, this will kill like the momentum of the story if we do this faithfully, you mm-hmm. know, if we do Tom Bombadil, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've talked to people who love Lord of the Rings, the books, and they're like, they didn't do Tom Bombadil, you know, and that's a big problem. And it's like, I read Tom Bombadil. I had no idea what was going on. I mean, it's cool and it's cool world building. And it's definitely like it expands like the feeling of wonder and mystery of the world in the books. But in terms of getting across to a wide audience, what's necessary and the reason why that's happening, you just couldn't do it. And same thing goes with, I don't know, if they could have done anything differently, if they could have figured out how to adapt it differently. The scouring of the Shire is, you know, very important to Tolkien's kind of idea of like heroes and war and victory, and how when you have a victory and you have heroes come back from war, that what they come back to may not be exactly what they left, and what they were fighting for sometimes can be lost while they're off fighting for it. You know, it's a very definitely very different and interesting and important kind of message that was very difficult. I completely understand it was very difficult to kind of have this big climax and big, and then you have to wrap up all the loose ends and everything. There's so much to wrap up in Lord of the Rings. I remember in the midnight showing of Return of the King, and I remember some guy yelling out, "Just end it already," because they kept, you know, fading to black and fading to black after every ending. And I was like, come on, man, do you not want the payoff for all this stuff? But you know, it would have been very hard for them to kind of ramp things back up into kind of another mini story after that, and not have a clean closure. I think they did still try to keep the spirit of that Frodo came back. He still wasn't the same. It still wasn't able to fully come back and fully things be like they were for him. But yeah, the Lord of the Rings movies were not 100% faithful, but they were really good adaptations because they knew what to change. They knew where the spirit of the story was, like you said, and how to get that across in the medium. Have you read Aragorn, right?
The dragon.
Yeah, the first book of the Inheritance Cycle.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever read Aragorn, Johan?
Yeah, I think back in high school. I've seen the movie.
I've seen the book.
I remember I got the book in high school, yeah.
I don't even know enough to really know why it wasn't a good adaptation. I mean, it wasn't a great movie. I just remember being like, just not really understanding the motivations of people, and it felt kind of derivative, and I don't know, just didn't care a lot about the characters and what was going on.
It's been a while since I've both read and watched that movie and that book.
I just know that's a notoriously bad adaptation.
But I remember them taking too many liberties with things, if I remember correctly, or changing things up. Like, it didn't follow the storyline as it was supposed to, and it kind of cut out a lot of things that were important, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
A lot of personal character things.
Mm.
Once again, it's been a while since I've both read and watched that movie. So I'm not the best at
remembering. Yeah. And I just remember... I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I remember the author of Aragorn was very young when he wrote. I think he was like 16 or so when he wrote the first book. And I think even he admits a lot of it was because you mentioned it being derivative or feeling derivative. A lot of it came from Star Wars. Like, it's essentially, you know, a New Hope, but with dragons.
Right.
That's actually, I never thought about that, but that's actually relatively good.
Well, and you know, you can do that if you do it well. I mean, like, there's so many stories that are the same story in the skeleton of it, you know, but when you have good characters and just cool things are happening, you don't necessarily care as much. But I think what happens in adaptations a lot of times when they don't work out is the people, the ones adapting it kind of second guess, almost like second guess the material, you know, where they're like, yeah, but we need to have this because Lord of the Rings came out, you know, so we have to have this big battle scene, like lots of people fighting, or we have to have this strong such and such character because we need to cater to this demographic and things like that. And it's almost like second guess. It's like, if the story is good, if the story resonates with people in this medium, in this form, then if you the best thing to do is to translate it as closely as you can, as much as you can salvage, and to not like say, you know, like you were saying, if you, we have to take these big liberties, because in a movie form, you've got to have these certain things. Like, I think, you know,
well, I'll say a great example of letting a story continue to be a story instead of trying to add in all these extra things, is Dune.
Yeah, I was just
Dune. Dune did a really good job, because Dune is very visually appealing as a movie, and it's got a good story. But like, some people, and I know my wife was one of those people, like, can get kind of bored because it is a little bit slower going, because there's a lot of world building and there's a lot of different story going on. But the movie itself was a really good adaptation, and it was really well done. I loved the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very faithful to the book. The first half of the book.
Right.
I would agree with that. I think a lot of that's because Denis Villeneuve, the director, was this was a passion project for him. You know, he loves Dune, and he wanted to have it be a faithful adaptation, which is why, you know, we only get the first half of the first book, because, you know, he's like, this is just too much story to squeeze into a single movie. And I want to be able to do it justice. And I think he was able to, and you had a filmmaker who, you know, could make decisions like that. And then a studio, I believe it's Warner Brothers, that was willing to play ball and say, oh, hey, you know, we'll go along with your creative decisions because we trust you. You know, you did Blade Runner 2049 and like, you seem to know what you're doing. And yeah, I think that's part of the reason why we get, you know, such a good adaptation with Dune.
And it was one that didn't need major battles or all crazy fight scenes or anything like that. You know, it was one that was able to tell a story that was told in the book, be faithful to it, and still be a really good movie. You know, I think you're right that sometimes adaptations are like, we need to have some visually aggressive scenes, you know, with like major battles or this cool fight scene or whatever. And it kind of takes away from the story a little bit when you do that, especially when you start changing things around. And sometimes I agree with you. You just need to let the story be told, because they're obviously, if you're making an adaptation on it, it's probably a good story. Tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I 100% agree. I think story is king. And that's where it should lead into, you know, and I know, Josh, you mentioned how Lord of the Rings was not, you know, they didn't get everything right to the detail, you know, as far as adapting it, but they captured the heart of it, the essence. And I think that's what a good book to film adaptation. So when you're looking at, you know, like, let's say books versus film and televisions as mediums, these two, they're very different and they do different things. I don't think one is necessarily better than the other, but you really have to understand the things that they do functionally to bring out the story. You know, an example, so with books do an excellent job at showing internal monologues and like thoughts that characters have, and you feel very close to characters. So when they make decisions, you understand why they're doing what they're doing. But if you were to just kind of see it on screen without knowing their thought process behind it, you know, it might not resonate and could throw an audience off. So there's this book, Girl on a Train, which is a fantastic book. It's a thriller. You know, you follow these three female protagonists, and then you hear all their stories and how they're interconnected. And I've not seen the film, but I've heard that it was not well received, and that people didn't enjoy it as an adaptation. And I can kind of see why. Because a lot of the decisions that they make have to do with a lot of the emotional turmoils and things that they go through, that they really get you inside of those characters. And so when they do make a decision, you know, if you were to watch from the outside on screen, you're like, well, that doesn't make sense. And it becomes harder to follow. But, you know, like I said, one medium isn't better than the other. One of the cool things that you really get to do with film and television, you know, you can have soundtracks. you know, like Jaws the book versus Jaws the film. We remember that iconic John Williams score. You know, and there's also, you know, if a picture, how do I say it? If a picture says 1,000 words, then what does 24 frames a second tell you? You know, it's a visual storytelling. So you have to be able to, you know, take a work from a book and say, hey, what is the story and how can I use the benefits of this medium, film and television, to bring out that story? So I think directors and studios that sort of recognize it and pursue the story first and then, you know, think about how you translate that, do really well.
Absolutely. I think it can be difficult too for adaptations. And this is a big one for me personally, I'll say artist, whatever. When I read, I tend to really try to visualize what I'm reading. And so a lot of times I'll reread different scenes to really get the visual of it. I'll sit there and wait a little bit longer to visualize the character than that. So then when I read a book, a good example of this for me was Terry Brooks's Sword of Shannara. Read the book, loved the book. They made a TV show. And how I visualized everything was very different than the TV show did. And so I had a hard time watching the TV show. And then after I watched the TV show, I had a hard time going back and reading the book because now I had the visual of the TV show in my head and I didn't enjoy the book as much. Mm. And I'll say Sword of Shannara is one of those adaptations that I didn't enjoy. I didn't think they were necessarily very faithful to the book in how the setting was portrayed because of just how his setting is in that book.
Yeah. I was going to say it's crazy how after we've seen a film adaptation, we'll start to bring that back into the book world. I feel like it would be hard to read Lord of the Rings without imagining, you know, the New Zealand landscape, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you sort of bring that, or read Harry Potter without picturing the actors that portrayed the characters in the films.
Yeah, that's a good, definitely a good series that was, I think, well adapted. I don't know if I'd put it up there with Lord of the Rings necessarily, but they definitely pulled it off, you know.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, there's aspects of certain things that I regret that, like, you know, I think Ron's character got a little oversimplified in the movies, to be a little too comic relief. Mm-hmm. At times, you know, there were things they you know, in trying to simplify things, try to give Hermione the like smart, thoughtful kind of lines and things like that. And so there were even some lines like Ron had that gave to Hermione and things like that. But overall, like, the reason it works, I think, is because there's like this core story happening in Harry Potter about, you know, Harry's past and his destiny and how, you know, the classic like hero that has it thrust on him, you know, it's like he didn't ask to be the chosen one. He doesn't know how to be the chosen one. He doesn't really know how to do this. And yet somehow he's put in the middle of this and he's got, you know, Dumbledore and everyone kind of depending on him, putting a lot on him. And that really, they really communicated that well through the movies, you know, all the way to the final book. You know, also like a trick with adaptations is cast, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that they were able to keep the continuity of the cast, especially for those three, was so important because of the emotional, like, they're the emotional core of the movies and of course the books. But, you know, that's definitely something that's very important, is casting right, because, you know, you have a character that really comes off a certain way in the book, in a book. And that's one thing that if you cast right, you can get you lose so much in movies in that medium with the internal monologue and all that, and like understanding the character through their internal thoughts and things like that. But if you cast the right person that really gets that character and kind of is able to emote so much of what that character kind of internally was represented by, then you really can communicate a lot of that, you know? And that's something I think, you know, like Harry Potter is a great example. And that's, I think, another, you know, to go back to like Lord, even Lord of the Rings, that's a very big strength of Lord of the Rings is the cast, you know, how they really nailed the cast. And they went so far as to be however many weeks or months into shooting that they recast Aragorn because they realized they had cast him too young. And, you know, who could imagine a different Aragorn now, right? Viggo Mortensen. Yeah, I think that's definitely a very important part and a challenging part with casting. I mean, a challenging part with adaptations is casting the right people. If you just pick, you know, just the big blockbuster person, right? You can pull in people, you know, but that adaptation may not last. It may not stick. It may not become what it could be. I'm trying to think of it as like a really poorly cast, like adapted character.
George Clooney and Batman.
Yes. That's a very good one.
Yeah. And you know, that's such a good point. I had not considered that, but casting is so, so important. Like, I don't know. I feel like if I were the casting director, the person in charge of casting, that would be a nerve-wracking role. Especially if you were adapting like a big IP, like something like Lord of the Rings. I didn't realize that they had to recast Aragorn, but I'm so glad that they did.
I think too with Harry Potter, what helped them succeed a lot in Harry Potter is they did a really good job in the movies of portraying the atmosphere of like Hogwarts.
Capture that well.
They capture it very well. And this has come from someone who watched the movies before I read the books. I wasn't allowed to read them when I was growing up as a kid. I kind of became one of those people that was like, I refuse to read these because they're so popular.
Yeah.
I watched the movies and I was like, okay, these are really good. I'll read the books. Yeah. But yeah, I feel like that's what really succeeded with Harry Potter is one, the casting, but two, they did such a good job of capturing the atmosphere and the setting of Hogwarts and the Wizarding World. And it's one of my favorite things about watching those movies is when I watch those movies, it just draws me in because of just like even the first movie, just watching them, you know, as little kids learning magic in this Wizarding World. It's just so fun.
Yeah. That's definitely something that they did, well, because in the books are like, I mean, the books are so atmospheric and the magic of the world expresses itself in so many tiny little ways. And they definitely latched onto that when they made the movies. And that's the kind of stuff that if you do that, you kind of like that, get kind of the immersion that brings kind of helps you get into the story and kind of accept the rules and things that are happening. So it's very important.
Yeah. Very immersive. Have you guys been to the Harry Potter World at Universal? That is a super immersive experience. I love going. I've been to there so many times, like as an adult. We were there like this past summer, and it was one of those things where it's like, okay, this is going to be, you know, a stretch logistically and financially to make it and do this. Do we want to? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go to Harry Potter World. And that's what we're going to do at Universal Studios. And we're going to go to both parks. We're going to go to Islands of Adventure and Universal Studios, and we're going to take the Hogwarts Express to travel between the two. Because we want to be lost in that world. So they did a fantastic job at the parks doing that.
Yeah, my wife's a big fan of Harry Potter and she loves going to the Wizarding World. We had passes for a while there and she would go with other friends even without me because she just loved going to the Wizarding World so much. So it's very, definitely very immersive.
Yeah, and like the way they capture a lot of the details. So I think it was in the very first Harry Potter book, the way they described going into Diagon Alley, that you could walk by and like not even know it's there. And so, you know, when you're walking in Universal Studios just outside the Wizarding World, like there are these kind of like, it looks almost like a carving out for like people to go in and out of the bathroom. Like there's no sign for it or anything. It's just kind of there. Like you would walk by without knowing it's there. But if you go around the corner and then all of a sudden, you know, it opens up to Diagon Alley. And I thought that was like, that was such a cool detail. Like from the books, and like being able to see that come to life was really cool.
But then speaking of other IPs that were adapted into like a real life type of amusement park, has any of you guys been to the Star Wars section of Disney World?
I haven't.
Not yet, no.
Not as good as Wizarding World.
Yeah. Really? No?
It's cool. And it was fun. But the problem, and this is the problem that they had compared to like Harry Potter World, is they what they chose as the park was a planet that no one has ever seen.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, different characters that no one knows about. It's like if they would have done like Mos Eisley or something like that, it would have been very different.
Yeah,
but they chose a thing that no one knew. And so it just, yeah, it's Star Wars and cool. The Millennium, you know, seeing the Millennium Falcon was definitely very cool. And seeing Stormtroopers walk around was cool, but it was not nearly as immersive as Harry Potter, because with the Harry Potter worlds, those are places we've seen, we've read, we've seen,
now
we're walking in it. With Star Wars, it was very different because I don't know any of this.
Yeah.
So it kind of pulled me out a little bit. And I haven't been back.
Yeah. That's a good point. You're still able to like make your own lightsaber though, right?
Yes. I mean, that was back when I went, was when it was first opened up. So it was all very expensive and a lot of people were waiting. Lines, that, probably, so right? We never even got to bother. I got to look at the lightsaber hilts. That was really cool.
Yeah.
You can still make your lightsaber, and that seems like it'd be really fun, but yeah, just not the same immersion.
Yeah. I mean that's unfortunate, because I feel like you could really do like a something Star Wars related that would do it justice. You know, just like you pick a setting from the original trilogy or the prequels, or even just a place where we're all familiar with, and then bring us there. And by the way, that's the beauty of the Millennium Falcon, is that you can kind of like plant it anywhere. So I wonder if maybe in the future they can change a lot of the settings and stuff around there.
I mean, that would be nice. Yeah, because they could do so many different things
that, well,
different areas. Yeah. But
well, then they're coming out with this thing called Star Cruiser, I think, which is like this hyper expensive experience. Yeah, where you can basically like stay in this, it's basically like a hotel or something, but it's made to be, the idea is for it to be like a completely immersive you know, experience where it's like you're staying on a Star Cruiser, Galactic Star Cruiser. The only thing is, once again, it's kind of similar to what Jeremiah said. The things they are choosing to kind of focus on and like really put as the center of their experience are things that are like less familiar, less core Star Wars stuff. Maybe I think there's a little bit more stuff from like the sequels and things, which is obviously great for the like the younger generation, that maybe like episode 7, 8, 9 is their entrance into Star Wars. But the people that are going to be going to that are going to be like, your audience are going to be the people paying the bills are going to be adults and people that are older than me that are, you know, have the money to go and spend there. So it's just kind of strange. And I mean, that's kind of like a little bit, Disney's been a little bit, it's been a little confusing how Disney has handled the Star Wars IP thus far in some ways. So it's kind of par for the course, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah. I feel like they got off footing probably around the time when The Last Jedi came out. And ever since, they've just been trying to keep themselves from falling. And like it's hits and misses, you know, I don't know. I feel like they're still trying to figure out what they're doing.
Yeah, I think
certain aspects are.
It's hard. I think it's hard. Like you have George, someone like George Lucas, or you know, someone that was one of the strengths of The Expanse. I think the adaptation of the show is that the writers, because the writers of The Expanse series are two guys and they write under a single pen name, but they were very much involved in adapting. I think they wrote the screenplays they wrote scripts and they wrote the outlines for each season and things like that. So they were very much involved in figuring out how to adapt this from this medium to this medium and what to cut and what not to cut and things like that. And so when you have this kind of, central visionary person that, has an idea and understands the material and what the fans are looking for and things like that, like George Lucas, although there definitely was a time where people didn't feel that way with him.
But it's also his world.
Right, right.
This is one of the things where you cannot argue with him because he's the one he had all that planned out.
Right. But people will. Yeah. People did. They don't so much now. They miss him now. But there's just the strength. That's just a strength of having that involvement from the person who originated the ideas, that they can kind of help you understand what it's about and why is this not Star Wars and why is this Star Wars
or someone sort of thing. Someone who also cares so much about the source material. So like a good example of not as an adaptation, but like taking the source material and running with it in the right way is Dave Filoni. He was the guy who did the Clone Wars cartoon show, and he basically worked under George Lucas for a long time. Was like a biggest fan of him, and wanted to stay true to George Lucas's vision, and that's why the Clone Wars TV show was such a big hit because he stuck to Star Wars.
Mm. He understood Star Wars. Dave Filoni, I feel like he's credited for understanding Star Wars. I think it was one of those behind the scenes specials of The Mandalorian where he talks about the Duel of the Fates and how, basically Anakin's tragic downfall is in part because he needed a father figure and Qui-Gon was that father figure, where Obi-Wan was more of a brother. And so, that's what the Duel of the Fates was about. And the fact that, Dave Filoni could explain that so eloquently, kind of showed you really understand that. And also George Lucas's, vision for Star Wars.
Absolutely. That's why all of his work is, of all the stuff coming out now, the stuff that he's part of is the stuff that feels the most Star Wars to me, at least.
Yeah, I think I think the one of the core things he maybe has described taking away from Star Wars is that it's about the importance of family.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a very big thing in Star Wars, and I actually even thinking about the sequels, some of the stuff I think that worked the best and that, I cared the most about in those movies was the dynamic between family.
Mm-hmm.
In those movies was the tension of Han and his runaway son and or Leia and her son and or even Rey and Kylo and their relationship and trying to sort things out and sort out their where they thought they fit in the galaxy in relation to their masters and things like that. That stuff was very intriguing. And I think, you can go back to the Mandalorian, right? And what is kind of the core glue of the Mandalorian? It's the relationship between the Mandalorian and this child, so family is definitely a very important key kind of component to the Star Wars movies.
Absolutely.
And Star Wars series. Yeah. And yeah, so.
Yeah. And it's... Yeah, and I will say that I think personally I'm not a huge fan of the sequel films, but I did appreciate those nuggets of family that they had in some of those movies. But I think their biggest problem is that they were kind of, George Lucas was a visionary. A lot of people will complain about the prequels. You can't deny that there is it does line up that is a consistent story a saga from beginning to end, where the sequels felt so disjointed because J.J. Abrams came in there with, I was about to say A New Hope, but what I meant to say was The Force Awakens. And so he made this like this fairly safe movie and like set up a bunch of ideas, but like didn't have a vision for how those ideas would play out. And so, you know, you had another filmmaker come in and decided to go in a completely different direction and like had his own vision for it. And then that got backlash, and then the studio got nervous, and then it's like, oh, well, let's go back to the vision that we didn't have a vision for. And it just all, you know, kind of, it didn't feel coherent.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that's probably like the simplest thing that would have, maybe not so simple, but like a very concise thing that to point out, if they had done that differently, if they had just said, no, we need to have if we're going to do a trilogy, we need to have an arc that we're working towards.
It needs to be consistent.
Right. I mean, even George Lucas, like even the original trilogy didn't have the same director for every movie, but the story was already outlined and laid out, and it was just a matter of, you know, executing it. I don't know, just Disney just underestimating fans.
They were playing on nostalgia.
Yeah, it's just nostalgia. I don't know, a little just kind of careless. I don't know exactly what to call it. Maybe nobody wanted to be the one to kind of take the baton and say, I'll be the one responsible for this three arc series.
Which is a huge thing to take on. I don't think I'd volunteer to take that on, as much as I love Star Wars. Like that's such a big thing. And you know, with J.J. Abrams is an interesting choice because he has this writing philosophy of, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, he has this TED talk about what he calls the mystery box, where he'll set up a mystery and he says, you know, the magic comes from the mysteries. Like, I don't even know what's in the box because it can be anything. And so he takes that process to writing, which can work, but you have to really nail the landing. And you have to be in the trajectory to go in there. And like, if you don't have a satisfying answer to what's in that mystery box, then it sort of takes the life out of it. And that was, a lot of people had complained about the show Lost for that reason, which was also spearheaded, by Abrams, because you have this mystery without the satisfying answers that we were looking for.
Yeah. I think that's just kind of shows that idea can only take you so far. Like, ultimately you could do the mystery in between, but if you don't have like an ultimate idea where you're going, then it's just not gonna be satisfying. And I mean, endings are so important to stories because it's the context, that's the full context of the story. You know, if you have a story without a good ending, could be, you could enjoy it or you could not be enjoying it that much, but the ending can make the whole story. You know, it can make everything that felt iffy, or I don't really buy it, or I don't really know if I'm feel this. And then the ending can just completely shift that whole thing. In the same way, you could be loving a story and you could be like, this story is amazing. It's the best book I've ever read. And then you get to the ending and you're like, you know, it just didn't all come together for whatever reason, and just can completely kind of change the way you feel about a story, you know. So that's it. Why people should take more care whenever they're, you know, thinking about those kinds of things.
I agree 100% with everything you just said. I think endings are very important. They're hard. They're hard to get to the landing. So I know there are writers, I feel like, that struggle with it more than others. But Brandon Sanderson, he has a class writing science fiction and fantasy that he teaches on at BYU, and he puts it all online on YouTube for free, so anyone can go and just watch it. You know, another reason why Brandon Sanderson is a fantastic human being. But one of the things that he talks about as far as endings and just writing in general. So when you start a story, you're making a promise to your reader. You're making a promise to your audience. And there are two directions you can go with that. You can either fulfill their promise. So when you say, oh, hey, this is the kind of story that I'm going to tell, these are the kinds of mysteries that I'm going to solve, you can either fulfill it. So, you know, let's say you promise to buy somebody a Toyota. And if you get them a Toyota, then they're very happy. Another direction that you can go is, you know, you exceed their expectations. So instead of a Toyota, you just got them a Tesla. And so now they're super happy. If you can do that as a writer, you know, people will be very happy with you. But you don't promise them a Toyota and then, you know, show up with a Vespa. You know, people will be very disappointed. And so, you know, I think that goes to, you know, I feel like one of the modern tropes is like to subvert expectations, you know, which I think can be done and can be done really well. But you have to be intentional about it. And if you're going to subvert expectations, you have to raise the bar. You have to give people more and not less. So I think the Force Awakens as a movie, you know, promised a lot and then did not, in my opinion, deliver on those promises.
Definitely. Yeah, no, that's definitely, I think the, I just don't, it's kind of wild to think about, you know, promises and payoffs are such kind of like, yeah, a big storytelling thing, to think that you are going to, you know, let us, you're going to say it's a saga. It's like a nine movie saga that you're wrapping up, and that you're going to have the first like film in the saga create all these promises and not have a defined payoff, you know? So, yeah, but maybe, and that may just be kind of a little bit, maybe it was just kind of a, result of them having someone like J.J. Abrams start the series, where he's like, you know, his philosophy sort of made them feel that the powers that be feel comfortable enough saying, well, we're going to do these promises and then we're going to hand it off to someone else and let them take it, run with it where they think they should. Yeah, definitely. The of those movies, they, you know, just kind of missed the mark there.
I mean, I definitely think part of the problem with that trilogy too is you had J.J. Abrams, who set up things, and then you had Rian Johnson come in the second movie and completely subvert everything that was set up, and then you had J.J. Abrams come back in and then reverse everything that Rian Johnson did. So it's almost like you had three movies that were battling each other to try and get what to the point.
Yeah.
Where I feel like if we had one director for all three movies, you probably could have gotten the point that you wanted without, it just seems like they were battling each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's where they really messed up the movies.
Even if the second movie, like even if people didn't like where the second movie went, and even if the second movie took it where it was going, I think in some ways it would have been better than what the third movie was, mm-hmm, which was trying to like backtrack over the second movie and stick a landing that, it didn't really have the runway to make, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like each movie was a scathing hate letter to its predecessor.
Absolutely.
And just trying to retcon everything that came before. But yeah, so with the whole Rian Johnson thing on The Last Jedi, I actually think Rian Johnson's a pretty talented filmmaker and writer. And, you know, if he would have had something of his own to like completely run free with, I think it would have been better than what we ended up with. But actually, you know, speaking, I know we're talking about adaptations. I feel like somebody like Rian Johnson does better with original work and original material, as opposed to trying to adapt something or trying to go into existing lore, you know, or a universe, something like Star Wars. So like if you've ever seen the movie Looper or, you know, Knives Out, you know, that's Rian Johnson, like, you know, having creative and freedom control. So it'd be interesting and cool if he had his own space opera that was, you know, maybe not Star Wars, but, you know, something that could be a love letter to Star Wars.
Or even Star Wars, just not dealing with the Skywalker people, Skosara.
I
agree. I think, because I've heard that before, is that Rian Johnson just, you know, Looper was a good movie. You know, he just needs that freedom to come with the own idea instead of trying to adapt something or work with pre-existing everything. Because now you're also working with characters that people love and care about, and you want the freedom to change things up, but you also, when you change things up, people get angry.
Yeah.
And you kind of do ruin the story to an extent, because that's, now you're not fitting in with what the story has been leading to. So.
Yeah.
Now, if you want an example real quick of a horrible adaptation, book to movie.
Okay.
You guys ever read the Percy Jackson series?
I have.
No.
It's an old YA. I don't even know if it's YA. It might even be youth. But it's a Greek mythology,
right?
Demigod thing. Read them when I was younger. Loved them. Horrible movie.
Uh-huh.
Completely changed the story. Changed the bad guy. No one liked it. And then they went and tried to make a second one and made it even worse. Changed the story completely. Tried to expedite things, make things faster. It was just probably one of the worst examples I could think of a movie adaptation done. Just,
I think that author got a lot of flack for that too, actually, now that I think about it.
Because the books are great. I think they're really good books, especially for like younger kids and or teenagers, stuff like that. The movies were just bad. Yeah. Not good movies.
So is that an example of where you felt like they just went and did something very different story-wise, or was it just like those small creative changes that just did not land?
Story-wise, they changed things with the antagonist, the true antagonist. And I watched dozens of those things where I actually watched the movie first when I was younger. And that the movie is actually what made me want to read the books. And then I read the books and I was like, wow, that movie was terrible compared to the book.
Hmm.
And it was because they followed along the basics of the first book, the story of the first book. But a lot of things were changed. And then story-wise, like especially the ending, story-wise, the antagonist was changed. His reasonings for doing things were changed. And it just had a lot less weight to it than the first book did. And then you get to the second movie that they did later on that was supposed to be off the second book. It's a 5-book series. And they try to go off the second book and just changed everything completely. They ended the series in that second movie when you had 4 other books with so much content that they tried to bring in the main bad guy. And it was just very poorly, poorly done. But I heard that they're making a TV show now. So I hope that they
maybe, I think it's Netflix as well.
No, it's Disney Plus.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
So hopefully they do better with that than they did with the movie.
Yeah. I feel like when it comes to adapting books, TV shows, you know, like are a better medium than a movie, because you're not trying to squeeze, you know, hundreds of pages into just like an hour and a half, 2 hours. You actually have, you know, freedom and room for that story to breathe and to really tell it in a way that will hopefully do it justice. I'd be curious when that is ready. I've heard of Percy Jackson. I know my sister was, I think she was a big fan of the series. I'd be very interested in that.
Yeah, I hope it turns out good.
There's some interesting series on the horizon, right? Because you got Rings of Power, you got that series, you got you were talking about, and I think I remember hearing about that, a Chronicles of Narnia series for Netflix.
They're doing Narnia?
They were supposed to. I don't know if it's still a thing. I think it is.
Seems like the right time, right? It's like, seems like this is what happens. You know, you have something start to get big, you know, like you have Rings of Power coming out, right? You had Wheel of Time and now you have Rings of Power. So it's like, just seems like that's kind of how things go. I mean, you had Lord of the Rings and the Harry Potter series coming out at the same time. And and stuff. It just seems like that's the mood of the way Hollywood would find the what people are eating up and then try to just churn it out as much as they can. But yeah.
Well,
anything else we should say about adaptations before we?
I think there's a lot we can say.
Well, yeah, there's just gonna be a lot more.
I don't know. I did think of one other adaptation. Have you guys ever read or seen Watchmen, the graphic novel?
I have not seen or read either.
Bits and pieces for me.
Okay. Yeah, that was a they had a movie come out in 2009 that was a Zack Snyder adaptation. And I just think that it's an interesting example in that it's very, very faithful to the source material. But I don't think it works super well as a movie. You know, like it's almost like frame for frame the same. But just like the beats and measures, like it feels like it may have, you know, been better as a TV show as opposed to a movie. But that was an interesting example. One of the few where, you know, a filmmaker is clearly very passionate about the source material. And it's not a bad movie. I think it's a decent film. It's just not, I don't think it's the best adaptation. But that was the only other example that I thought of.
Cool.
Well,
and what? No. And Johan, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. It was great to have you on. I'm excited just to have the rest of your books come out when they do eventually come out. I'll definitely be reading them. It'd be cool to maybe have you on the podcast again some other time as well.
Yeah. I'd love to be back on.
All right. Well, if you know, you can find Johan's book on Amazon, right? That's probably the best place to go.
Yes. You can search Keys of Time by Johan Martin. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. You can find it on my website, johanmartin.com.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Johan. And as we say, this has been the Bridge of Two podcast.
A far, far, far away bridge.
My little sister, when she's the first time she saw that movie, we were watching it at home on VHS or something. And whenever Gandalf goes, "There is only one Lord of the Ring, only one who can bend it to his will." And then that whole thing, my little sister goes, "That's God." Lord of the Ring, that's God.
Fair.
Well, yeah. Ultimately,
maybe not in this story.
Yeah,
that's great.